Job chapter 24 is where we want to look today. Job chapter 24. This chapter is a continuation of the discourse by Job begun in chapter 23. And it's been several weeks since we were in chapter 23. But in that chapter, we see Job longing for his day in court with God, because he is confident that he will be vindicated. One of the highlights of the book of Job is in chapter 23, verse 10, where he says, "He knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Job is sure that in the end, he will come forth as gold. He understands that he is being tried, tested, proven. He is confident that God is in control of the whole thing, that God knows the way that Job takes. If Job is a little overconfident here, we at least must admire his confidence in God. His overconfidence is dealt with later on when he does get an audience with God and he says, I can say nothing. I put my hand on my mouth and I'm speechless. But he is confident in God. Job's conscience is clear. His confidence is in the Lord. He can say, though mysterious and difficult, God's purposes are best. Then he continues this discourse in chapter 24, returning to the fatal flaw in the argument of Eliphaz and the others. He has exposed this fatal flaw back in chapter 12 in detail, as well as in chapter 21, especially those two chapters. The flaw in their argument, the fly in the ointment of Eliphaz and the others, is that the ungodly sometimes prosper in this life and sometimes appear to get away with their sin. Now we know that in the final analysis, no man gets away with his sin. And sin does not escape God's notice. Either the sinner pays for his sin, or Christ pays for his sin. But in the eyes of man, and in what appears from our present earthly perspective, sometimes the ungodly seem to get away with their sin. And Job returns to this point here throughout this whole chapter. He begins in verse 1 with a question that sort of summarizes everything that follows. He says, "Why, seeing times are not hidden from the Almighty, do they that know Him not see His days?" This is the key to Job's argument, and it is unanswerable. Eliphaz and the others cannot answer this question. Why, since God sees everything and God knows everything, why do those that know Him and those that follow and serve Him, why do they not see days? What kind of days? Days of judgment upon the wicked. At least that is my understanding of this question. Some of these statements in the book of Job, as we've already said, may allow more than one interpretation. But I believe this is the best one for verse 1. If God knows everything, then why does He not hasten to bring judgment upon the wicked, vindication upon the righteous? Why is God's justice not immediate? Why is there this delay? This the three friends of Job could not answer. And in some respects, even Job himself could not answer. The answer to some of these questions is only known to God. And this, my friends, is the fight of faith. To keep trusting God, even when He does not operate according to our time schedule. To keep believing that God is just, even when His justice does not presently appear. And to keep believing that God is a merciful God to His children, even when His mercy does not immediately appear. So he works this out in several ways here in this chapter. The way that I'm dividing it here is verse 2 through verse 12, first of all, in which Job speaks of the oppression that is wrought in the earth by some wicked people. Let's read these verses. Some remove the landmarks. Landmarks were property lines, fences, like what we use fencing for nowadays. He says, in the earth, some people remove landmarks. They, in other words, steal land, real estate. And they steal livestock. They violently take away flocks and feed thereof. Remember back in chapter 1, this is exactly what had happened to Job himself. The Sabaeans and Chaldeans came and took away his flocks and even killed his servants who were with those flocks. Now God sees all this. God sees the person moving that maybe a big stone that is a property boundary marker. And in the middle of the night, he sneaks out and maybe with the help of some other servants in his household, he rolls it maybe 10 or 20 feet further over to enlarge his own property. Now, God sees that. Then why doesn't God do something about it? Why does not God strike those men dead right there in the middle of the night on the spot? It isn't hidden from the Almighty. Then why doesn't God come to the rescue of that neighbor whose land is being stolen? Why? The friends can't answer it. And the only way that Job can answer it is, well, God is still just. And in the end, He will prove Himself just. Justice will not be fully served until the day of judgment. He continues to describe in verse 3 how that oppressors in the earth take advantage of others. They drive away the ass of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox for a pledge, which they were not supposed to do. They were forbidden to take advantage of the fatherless and the widows. And we're going to see him mention that one more time before we finish this chapter. And it is a fascinating study, and we may go into that sometime, about all that the Scriptures teach about the fatherless and the widows. There's more in the Word of God about that than you realize. I began to look into that recently. The Lord takes a special interest and gives special care for those who are weak and defenseless. And yet, there are occasions in which wicked men in the earth take advantage of these weakest ones, most vulnerable ones, and steal from them. Verse 4, they turn the needy out of the way. The poor of the earth hide themselves together. In other words, they run roughshod over the poor. And so cruel are they that they make the poor hide for safety and cower in fear when they see this wicked, powerful person coming along. Verse 5, behold, as wild asses in the desert, they go forth to their work, rising betimes for a prey. The wilderness yieldeth food for them and for their children. These wicked people, Job is describing, are like wild animals who range about to satisfy their own selfish, covetous desires. They get up early looking for a prey, for someone to prey upon, for an opportunity to take advantage of others. Verse 6, they reap everyone his corn in the field, and they gather the vintage of the wicked. They're stealing crops right out in the field, right out in the open. They have no fear of man, it seems, in that sense. They're powerful. No one dares to challenge them. They just go and gather and take from others right under their own noses sometimes. Historians tell us that groups like the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans of Job chapter 1 were common in these days, and they would just go around and they were a law unto themselves. They would just help themselves. And if they, unless you had a large plantation with lots of servants and a small army, then you were at their mercy. You were defenseless. Job himself had experienced this. And he says, God knows about all these things. Why doesn't He do something about it? He continues the description. Well, before we look at that, though, let me point out one more thing here in verse 6. They gather the vintage of the wicked. This is an important little detail here. But oftentimes, in earthly crimes and inequalities, we have simply one wicked person taking advantage of another wicked person. And just because someone is taken advantage of does not mean that they are righteous themselves. They may be, but they may not be. We must not think that just because someone has harmed us that therefore we must be right with God. I remember reading the story by Brownlow North of an elderly woman who was on her deathbed that he visited, and she had the strongest assurance of salvation. He inquired further and told, and she seemed to be such a sweet, gentle old lady on her deathbed. He inquired as to the grounds of her assurance of salvation. She said, I have been poor and I have suffered all of my life. And I know that God is not going to turn me away from heaven because I've suffered so much here. As if God owed her something better in eternity than what He had given her on earth. As if suffering here bought favors hereafter. When that was all the poor lady had to say, Mr. North did his biblical duty and informed her that her assurance was not well founded and pointed her to Christ. The woman was insulted. And if I remember the story correctly, he saw a side of her nature that he would never have known existed. She began to rail out against him, and a very sad case. Just because a person gets the short end of the stick in this life doesn't automatically mean that they're right with God. Sometimes the wicked gather the vintage of the wicked. Well, let's go on. Verse 7. They cause the naked to lodge without clothing, that they have no covering in the cold. They leave the weak not with even the basic necessities of clothing and shelter. Verse 8, they are wet with the showers of the mountains and embrace the rock for want of a shelter. They actually take the roof from over top of the head of the weak ones. They pluck the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge of the poor. They cause him to go naked without clothing, and they take away the sheaf from the hungry. You get a picture here in all these phrases of how destitute some people are left because of the mighty who are wicked, who take advantage of them. And the poor, fatherless, and widows in verse 11 make oil within their walls, and tread their wine presses, and suffer thirst. They may serve as slaves in the homes, within the very walls of these who take advantage of them. They make oil, but they don't get to benefit from any of it. In other words, to use another figure from the Scriptures, these wicked oppressors muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. And they do not let those who are treading out their wine presses enjoy some of the increase of the wine press. Men grown from out of the city, and the soul of the wounded crieth out. And here's Job's point. Yet God layeth not folly to them. Their cries and their sighs ascend from places where they are, outside of the city, outside of the protection of the walls of the city. They've been driven clean outside. And their cries and their sighs ascend. And yet God does not charge evil or sin or folly against those who have put them in those circumstances. God seems not to hear. He seems to pay no notice. He doesn't bring the oppressors to justice. Why? Why, seeing times are not hidden from the Almighty, do they that know Him not see His days? What Job describes here reminds us of Psalm 73. The prosperity of the wicked, the oppression of the righteous. Reminds us of Psalm 50, where the wicked carry on in all these ways, and God seems to take no notice. He keeps silence. And because God keeps silence, men think that God is just like one of us, that He's no more powerful than us, that He has no more of a sense of justice than ourselves. But that is to misread God's providence. We'll see more about that here as we proceed. Now, he in verses 13 through 17 speaks of deeds of darkness wrought in the darkness. Before we read these verses, it is interesting to see how that in Scripture darkness and light are used as a contrast to illustrate the difference between evil and good. Light often speaks of God and godliness. God is light, and in Him dwelleth no darkness at all. Figurative light and figurative darkness. Men love darkness because their deeds were evil, John 1 tells us. And what Job speaks of now in these next four or five verses is that these dark, evil deeds are oftentimes wrought in the dark of night. They are of those that rebel against the light. They know not the ways thereof, nor abide in the paths thereof. He gives us some specifics here. The murderer, rising with the light, killeth the poor and needy, and in the night is as a thief. And this business of rising with the light evidently speaks of very early in the morning, before the sun is fully up, when the shadows of night are still halfway present. This murderer is out and about. While honest men are arising for work, the murderer is arising for evil, to commit his crime. And the thief also, in the night, commits his crime, in the shadows. Verse 15, the eye also of the adulterer waiteth for the twilight, saying, no eye shall see me, and disguiseth his face. Here is a man with adultery in his heart, and during the light of day, he is anticipating and looking forward to the fall of night when he will be hidden, when no eye will see him, and he goes about to commit his sin of adultery, when he will be undetected. And in verse 16, in the dark, they dig through houses. Many of the houses in those days were, I guess, in somewhat comparable to a sod house in Oklahoma, in that you could dig through them. You could literally tear a hole in the side of a house fairly easily and make an entry undetected. And these wicked ones that Job is speaking of, they do that at night, in the dark. They dig through houses which they had marked for themselves in the daytime. They know not the light. These are nocturnal people. They hate the light of day. The only thing they can do in the light of day is go around and case the neighborhood and look for an easy target and then wait for night to come, so they can break in and help themselves. They hate to see the sun come up. Verse 17, for the morning is to them even as the shadow of death. So that means an end to their wickedness for a few more hours. If one knew them, they are in the terrors of the shadow of death. They don't want to be recognized or seen by their fellow man. Now, I've got to pause here and point this out and emphasize this. It doesn't seem to bother them at all that God sees in the night just as clearly as in the day. They're so worried that men will see them that they carry on these activities at night. Oh, the folly of the deeds of darkness and the doers of the deeds of darkness. They fear man when they ought to fear God. They don't want man to detect them, but they seem not to care that God detects them. Friends, nothing will keep us from sin like this, to recognize that we are always detected by God, that He is present everywhere, that He knows everything, that we are never really alone. Even in a crowd of people, we cannot hide. In the dark of night, we cannot hide from God. I believe it is true what Mr. Charnock said, that nothing will help to keep us from sin quite like remembering the omnipresence of God and the omniscience of God. We must watch. We must be careful what we look at, what we think about, what we say, the words that we may say to ourselves that we think no one else hears. We're never alone. At that magazine rack in the store, listen, you're never alone. In front of that television, you're never alone. In front of that computer screen, never alone. God is there. God is with us. And we ought to fear Him more than anyone else. Avoid temptation. Avoid the appearance of evil. I was listening recently to some of the old sermons by Brother Frazier, and I wish I could wax as eloquent as he did on these points. When I think of that brother, I tell you, I think of a man who was as straight as an arrow. He said in one sermon in Missouri there a few years ago, he said, to avoid the appearance of evil, if you're walking down the street past a bar, cross over to the other side. Because even after you've walked past it, someone may think that you have come out of it. You may say, that sounds kind of legalistic to me. Well, I'll tell you this. I've never heard anyone who ever accused Brother Frazier of drunkenness or hanging out at the bars. We need to be straight as an arrow for the glory of God. Do we fear God? Now, Job seems to sort of turn the corner here at verse 18, and he speaks of the final end of these wicked people. He is swift as the waters. Their portion is cursed in the earth. He beholdeth not the way of the vineyards. Now, this is one of the difficult verses here of this chapter, but I think it simply means this, that the life of all men, righteous or wicked, swiftly passes. But in the context here, of course, he's speaking especially of the wicked. Their life passes swiftly, as does everyone's. And they leave everything behind. Their portion is cursed in the earth. They don't take any of their wealth that is stolen with them. It stays and is cankered, just like all the rest of it, on this fallen earth. They no longer enjoy the delicacies of this life. He beholdeth not the way of the vineyards. When he's gone, his pleasures have ceased. Drought and heat consume the snow waters, verse 19. So doth the grave those which have sinned. Death moves in swiftly. Verse 20, the womb shall forget him, the worm shall feed sweetly on him, he shall be no more remembered, and wickedness shall be broken as a tree. This world will forget him, or perhaps even his own family, or if his mother outlives him, in some respects even she will forget him, he's gone out of sight. Some think that the term womb here refers to the earth itself. The earth will forget him. And the next phrase might lend credibility to that way of looking at it. The worm shall feed sweetly on him. Isn't that picturesque? Think of these little worms just feasting away on the body of this wicked man in the grave. And like a tree that is rotted, that keeps standing for a while, I can show you some out in my neck of the woods, and after a while, after a few years, doesn't take too long, you can just go and push on them and they will just, the whole trunk just falls over dead on the ground. The wickedness shall be broken as a tree. He, verse 21, evil entreateth. Wait a minute, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just pause here before we get to verse 21. Job's point here is that the wicked do die. The wages of sin is death. But it's all a matter of timing. And Job, in what he says in verses 18 through 20, in a sense agrees with what the three friends have said. And that is, the wicked will not prosper. But it's all a matter of timing. They will not prosper in eternity. They will not prosper when they die. Job can say to them, I agree with you, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that the prosperity of the wicked is short. But how short? When does it end? For some of them, it doesn't end until the grave. They will die, and then they will suffer. They will suffer forever at the hand of God. The issue is, do they always suffer before they die? And this is the difference. Eliphaz and the others say, yes, they always suffer in this life before they die. Job says, no, not always. Not always. Remember, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the very day that Noah entered into the ark. They didn't suffer in this life. And in a moment, their suffering began in death and judgment. Job's case is the right case. Job has the proof. These men don't want to admit it. He now comes back in verse 21 and gives a further description of the wicked. He evil entreateth the barren that beareth not. He's cruel to those who are not able to have children. And doeth not good to the widow. Here again is the second reference here to the widow. He's cruel to those that are lonely and defenseless. Sin of omission. He simply fails to do good to the widow, he says. Verse 22, he draweth also the mighty with his power. He riseth up and no man is sure of life. He gets so bold and brazen that he doesn't just go after the weak and defenseless. He goes after those that are mighty as well. He begins to be so proud and lifted up that he and so confident that he's afraid of none and he goes after all. And in that case, no man is safe around him. No man is sure of life. And even though he himself is safe, even though this wicked man in this world is safe and secure and has more than he could possibly want, nevertheless, he's not content. And he's constantly on the lookout for someone else that he can take advantage of. Verse 23, though it be given him to be in safety whereon he resteth, yet his eyes are upon their ways. Verse 24, they are exalted for a little while, but are gone and brought low. They are taken out of the way as all other and cut off as the tops of the ears of corn. Job here is a sort of summarizing his case. He says, they're exalted, yes, but it's for only a while. It doesn't endure into eternity. They end up being brought low after this life is passed. They die like all other men. They're cut off as the tops of the ears of corn. They reach maturity and maybe old age. God lets them live a long time, and then He cuts them off. And then their pain and their sorrow begins, and it will never end. This is Job's argument against these men, and it is an argument that they cannot bear, that they cannot answer. These things are so. Now, why God does this is not altogether answerable. Why He allows some wicked to prosper in the earth for a long time, even to old age, is simply God's wise providence that He has ordained. I'll say more about that in just a moment. Let me point out verse 25. If it be not so now, who will make me a liar and make my speech nothing worth? Job lays the challenge here. He says, I'm so sure that what I have said is true, I dare anyone to prove me wrong. I lay out the challenge for anyone to prove me wrong. This is the boldness of one who knows that he has the truth. The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion. And here is the boldness of Lion Job. L-I-O-N, Job. Thank God when we can have this holy boldness and know that we speak the truth of God. Well, this is the end of this discourse. Let me make a few observations here before we draw to a close. The first is this. The way that we treat the defenseless and the weak is a measure of who we really are. Think of the widows and the fatherless that he mentions here, the orphans. How we treat those is a great barometer of our own appreciation to God for His mercies toward us. And sometimes when there's a case in the news that makes a lot of headlines about so-called euthanasia, we hear comments to this effect. And it is a valid argument. It is a biblical argument. How we treat those who are the weakest among us says much about who we are as a society, even as a church. And I keep telling you that there's a widow lady there in Granite City, Illinois, that is going to need our help. And let's remember these things. Let us not be what Scripture calls a respecter of persons, but be ready and willing to help, in this case, those that are widows indeed, according to 1 Timothy 5. Another observation, let us use a biblical measure, not a carnal measure. Worldly wealth is as much a mark of the wicked as it is of the wise. It is one of those uncertain evidences that does not prove one way or the other about a person's true relationship to God. Matthew Henry puts it this way, we cannot say that all who are in trouble are wicked, For it is certain that all who are in prosperity are not righteous. God gives to some of His enemies temporal judgments before the final judgment comes. But to others, it is all reserved for later. And they, unlike their fellow sinners, seem to enjoy much success. Again, back to verse 1. Why? Why don't we see days of judgment to vindicate the righteous and to punish the wicked in this life? It's God's decision. It's a sovereign prerogative. And frankly, God does not owe us an explanation as to why He deals with some wicked people in one way and other wicked people in another way in this life. If God does it, it is good, it is right. And it is only our measure that is wrong. It is our measure of fairness that is askew if we have a problem with God's providence. Another observation. Let us not be envious of the wicked in their prosperity. Psalm 73 addresses that straight on. Don't be envious of the wicked like the ones who are described here in Job 24. It appears like a happy life, but it's not. And it certainly does not lead to a happy hereafter. We ought to desire instead a happiness which this world cannot provide. A happiness which cannot be found in anything terrestrial, but is only found in the true and living God. Listen to old James Durham. He says, "Look to the frailty of your life while you prosper. Know you are but exalted for a time, and remember, eternity is on the back of it." Eternity is coming. And no matter how much prosperity we may have in this life, let us remember, eternity is coming. Fourthly, let us not pursue a sinful course because others appear to get by with the same. There is that statement from Ecclesiastes that is so relevant here. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Or in the words of the New Testament, God is slack concerning His promise. That's what the wicked say. God's not going to judge after all. He just made these empty threats. We're getting by with it. Look at us. Well, we might as well pursue a sinful course. No, no. Visible judgments are, for the most part, rare. Visible judgments, temporal judgments, are, for the most part, rare. God is very patient. He is very slow to bring down the sword of justice in this life, in this world. But God's justice is sure. It is as sure as it is slow. And let us not misinterpret His patience for slackness. And last of all, like Job, when we cannot see and we cannot answer all of the whys to our satisfaction, let us simply keep walking faithfully in the path of duty. Walk in the path of obedience by faith. And patiently await God's justice. It will come. Just be patient and wait. If you are righteous, you will be vindicated. If you are wicked, your sin will catch up.